supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The Environmental Protection Agency changes course, now saying that hydraulic fracturing for oil and gas can impact water supplies. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The agency released its final report on the controversial technology responsible for Pennsylvania's shale gas boom. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on how the EPA has shifted its stance.
The EPA's initial draft fracking report, released in June of 2015, said the process did not cause, quote, widespread systemic impacts on drinking water. Oil and gas companies praised the conclusion, but environmentalists lambasted the report. And EPA's own scientific review board criticized the conclusion, saying it did not hold up to the science reflected in the body of the report, and that included instances of water contamination in Pennsylvania. Now the EPA says fracking for natural gas and oil can hurt drinking water supplies under, quote, some circumstances. Michael Halpern is with the Union of Concerned Scientists, which was critical of the EPA's initial report.
It was clear from the day the report was released that the language could not be supported by the science. And the scientific advisors were clear, and a lot of scientists, when they made public comments, were clear that there was no evidence for the claim that there was no widespread systemic impacts of fracking on drinking water.
The EPA looked at how the industry used water, sand, and chemicals to force oil and gas out of rocks buried deep underground. The agency also looked at the risks of transporting and disposing wastewater. Eric Melito is with the American Petroleum Institute. He says the group is now disappointed with the EPA's conclusion.
We're not going to stand here and say no incidents occur. What we're going to say is this is a technology that's been around a long time. It's been successfully deployed. The risks are low. It's a very safe technology.
The EPA says poor well construction, wastewater spills, and storage in unlined pits can lead to water pollution. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
This afternoon wrapped up day one in a pretrial hearing for Bill Cosby's criminal case. The case revolves around a single alleged assault. But prosecutors are arguing a jury should hear testimony by 13 other women who accuse Cosby of drugging and assaulting them. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that court watchers say this is a crucial piece of evidence.
What is already known about the details of the alleged 2004 assault of Andrea Constant by comedian Bill Cosby? During a 2005 deposition, Cosby described the sexual encounter as consensual. Now, says celebrity attorney Gloria Allred, the burden is on the prosecution to prove one thing.
In plain English, that Andrea Constant, the named victim, that she did not consent.
Speaking to reporters outside the Montgomery County Courthouse, Allred said that's why the district attorney's office is bringing in 13 other accounts that are, quote, strikingly similar to Constance. Constance says Cosby gave her pills, which made her semi-conscious and unable to consent. Allred and the prosecutors say Cosby had a pattern of non-consensual sex with women, and that strengthens the case.
For example, that he was an older man, that they were younger women. That he gave them either alcohol or drugs or both, that they became incapacitated such that they could not consent.
Allred represents some of these proposed witnesses. Defense attorneys also introduced evidence they say will show the women's stories are not similar enough to be considered and should be tossed out. After fighting for nearly 6 hours over what evidence the judge can consider to make this determination, District Attorney Kevin Steele began laying out his side's facts. Both legal teams will be returning to Norristown to begin arguing over the individual women's stories. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
It's the time of year for the Nutcracker, the ballet about armies of mice and sugar plum fairies. This year marks the 200th anniversary of the story on which that ballet is based. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports an historic house in Delaware is celebrating the story by the German romantic writer E.T.A. Hoffmann.
Much of the original story, The Nutcracker and the Mouse King, first published in 1816, is a fantasy about how the Nutcracker became a nutcracker. In order to save a princess, a young man who had never shaved nor worn boots had to crack an unbreakable nut, the Krakatoa nut, and hand it to the princess, and then walk backward 7 steps. He stumbled that last part, so he was cursed into becoming a nutcracker. That kind of fairy tale logic is hinted at the historic Wilson House in Odessa, Delaware. Assistant curator Brian Miller dressed up the rooms of this 18th century mansion to resemble an upper-class German Christmas party of that era, with clues to the original story.
You know, we start with what they do know, but then we tell them a little bit more, or we tell them what are the differences, what are the similarities. For example, you know, the whole Act Two in the ballet, it's all for dancing. Well, there wasn't dancing in the original story of 1816.
Clara of the ballet was originally named Marie in the story by E.T.A. Hoffman. Miller nods to that story by putting 7 tiny bejeweled crowns next to Marie's bed. Those are the spoils from the 7-headed mouse king whom Marie defeated with her slipper. That's a detail often missing from the ballet. This exhibit is a break from the historic house's usual fare. For example, there are 160 different kinds of nutcrackers scattered throughout the house. Miller says he gets to be funky during the holidays.
It allows us to be way more creative, and it doesn't have to stick to the documentation of the house. It also allows us to fill the rooms, because usually the rooms are much sparser, you know, 18th century. They don't have as much stuff out as we normally are used to at our own homes today.
The Nutcracker story also allows Miller to decorate the house with German beer steins, because as a proper English Quaker house, it would never have had such things in it. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Still ahead this evening, an unexpected turn of events at an exhibit in Philadelphia in 1966 is remembered on its 50th anniversary.
What the people attending the event got was a very loud concert with music that was unlike any being made in rock or popular music at that point.
The Velvet Underground comes to town as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
For Jimmy Brown.
50 years ago this month, attendees at the YMHA in Philadelphia were treated to what was promoted as a, quote, mixed-media discotheque complete with Andy Warhol and underground films. Tomorrow evening at the same venue, now known as the Gershman Y, rock critic and author Richie Underberger will offer perspective on that event in a talk entitled Visions of the Velvet Underground. Richie, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
And among the many books you've penned is one entitled White Light, White Heat, The Velvet Underground Day to Day. First, let's go back 50 years. That event was transplanted from New York City, where Warhol and the group Velvet Underground hailed from. Safe to say Philadelphia was somewhat unprepared for that spectacle?
I think that they were expecting a more or less conventional contemporary art exhibit featuring work by Andy Warhol, who was already famous at that time. Andy Warhol asked if he could bring his multimedia show down, and instead, what the people attending the event got was a very loud concert with music that was unlike any being made in rock or popular music at that point, with its lyrics about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Also bringing in concepts from contemporary composition, the avant-garde, and fierce electronics. And on top of that, you had these dazzling strobe lights and these dancers that were also part of the show that came down from New York. And this offended the sensibilities of some of the more straight-laced patrons of the arts who attended the event, who were not expecting anything of this sort. And I'm really glad that with the perspective of time, the same venue is now honoring that event on its 50th anniversary, because the Velvet Underground in particular were a great and very important and innovative rock group.
Put that descriptive very important in context. How would you, from this vantage point, describe their legacy?
The Velvet Underground's legacy is hard to overestimate. They broke grounds in 2 very significant areas. First of all, with their songs, which were mostly written by Lou Reed, they addressed subjects, and not just the sex and drugs that get a lot of attention, But the everyday life of living in the Bohemian underground in an urban environment, New York's was their environment, that were not depicted very realistically in rock or popular music, and certainly not with that kind of vernacular language that Lou Reed was using. I almost consider Lou Reed to be a journalist of human emotion, recording what's there almost like a reporter. But also I think they were groundbreaking in that, especially through John Cale's experience with minimalist composers like Lamont Young, in whose group he played, they brought in elements of the avant-garde in the drone that they used, in the repetitious figures, which are a trait of minimalist music, which was emerging at that time, and also improvisation. Lou Reed admired free jazz musicians like Ornette Coleman, and also new possibilities that were opened by electronic distortion, both in the guitars that they were using and also in John Cale's viola. All of this together combined for a music that was unlike any that had been heard before, but it also gave courage and encouragement to countless other groups that emerged that wanted to do something different, unique, and uncommercial.
Not a surprise then that that outsider-in attitude would come to the attention of Andy Warhol. How did this specific pairing take place?
A few of Warhol's associates happened to see the Velvet Underground playing at a dive in Greenwich Village called the Café Bizarre. They thought, this is fantastic, because not only does this group, which has still not made a record, have these great, unusual, original songs, but visually and in their presentation, they very much complement what Andy Warhol is representing in the movies that he was starting to make in the mid-1960s. These characters who will be considered deviant by society of that time, his movies were just documenting what these characters were doing in their lives. Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground were doing the same thing, I think, in their music. And they weren't just doing it through their lyrics, but also in the sonic arrangements that they were using for the songs, which could vary from very slow and what we would call minimalism now to very fierce, using a lot of feedback and shrieking electronics. And as it happened, Andy Warhol was looking for a rock group to work with because he had the opportunity to present a rock band in a club. And he and the people around him thought, this is a great band to work with. And the Velvet Underground similarly thought, it's great to work with Andy Warhol, first of all, as a manager. He can buy us new equipment and help get us gigs, but also he understands our sensibility, which hardly anybody else with power in the media did at that time.
Richie, to say that White Light, White Heat, The Velvet Underground, Day by Day is extensively researched is a huge understatement. Thank you so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you for having me on, Dave.
Rock critic and author Richie Unterberger, and you can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. What a difference a two-hour drive can make. Students in Erie, Pennsylvania, attend a public school district that's teetering on the brink of collapse, all while being surrounded by thriving suburban districts. It's a microcosm of Pennsylvania's system, which has been called the most inequitable in the nation by the U.S. Department of Education. But if those students in Erie were born just 2 hours north in the Canadian province of Ontario, they'd find a much different picture. Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCrory went there to study the contrast.
On a recent morning in Toronto, Rose Avenue Elementary principal David Crichton introduced me to one of his fourth grade students, Taqi Alid, a refugee who arrived from Syria in 2014.
Can you tell him what you like about school?
It's so fun.
Yeah, what do you learn?
I learned English. When I came here, I never knew English, but I was here 2 years and I know English.
Yeah. And where did you come from?
I have to come here because there was war in Syria, that's why.
As principal of Rose Ave, Creighton's ability to interact with students of all backgrounds and abilities is a must.
Hi.
The school sits below the tight collection of towering high-rises that makes up St. Jamestown, a poor, jam-packed, and extremely diverse neighborhood in Toronto. Locally, it's known as the world in one block, and the student body reflects that.
All right, we're going to line up Yes, so Kadir, can you stand up? And Kristala, Ayush, Sabika.
Our community mainly comes from Pakistan, India, Nepal, Sri Lanka. We're getting a number from the Middle East now, so Syria, Iraq. Many of them do not speak any English or are learning English, so that's one of our challenges.
Based on the low income levels and language barriers of the students, it may be natural to assume that the school is an academic low performer, but quite the opposite. In most subjects, students at Rose Ave score on par or better on Ontario-wide tests than the city and provincial averages. Compared to Pennsylvania, where there's a strong correlation between test scores and family income, this is nothing short of shocking. So what's the difference? In part, Principal Creighton says it comes down to a commitment to equity.
There is a recognition that resources, be that money, be it people, be it my time, is absolutely focused on those kids who need additional support.
That logic is making a difference not just at Rose Avenue, but across the province. Over the past two decades, Ontario has become widely praised for its education system. High school graduation rates have steadily climbed, and the province ranks highly on international tests, the same ones where the United States falls in the middle of the pack. Educators in Ontario cite many reasons for this success, but much of it comes back to this idea of equity, and from their vantage point, a state like Pennsylvania has been disregarding it at its own peril.
You've got it wrong in terms of, you know, looking at just basic issues of social justice.
In the 1990s, the education system in Ontario looked a lot like Pennsylvania's does today, with school funding based largely on local wealth. But then, Ontario made a few key changes. It eliminated the local school property tax and began fully funding schools at the provincial level. It greatly reduced its number of school districts, which widened the racial, social, and economic diversity of each system. And crucially, it decided to provide more funding per pupil to the districts serving students who face the greatest obstacles. And at Rose Avenue, that's made a big difference for students like Taki, says Creighton.
I allocated 4 staff to ensure that every kid in grade 1 who wasn't reading at grade level got daily instruction in a small group setting.
This need-based flow of resources is not what happens in Pennsylvania. Most school funding is generated locally, and the bulk of state dollars are very unscientifically distributed without gauging student need. That amounts to a system that favors families who have the means to live in wealthy areas. And even though Pennsylvania has fewer students than Ontario, it has more than 5 times the number of school districts. Some districts in the state are so tiny, poor, and predominantly black that it's hard not to question the rationale behind the boundary lines.
Okay. What's the 5 food groups? Name them.
In Ontario, the student-based distribution of dollars doesn't stop at the provincial level. Within the Toronto district, more money is systematically directed to the 150 neediest schools, and that includes Rose Avenue and, near the very top of the list, Nelson Mandela Elementary, where Jason Kandankery is principal.
I'm sure as you did the walkthrough, you kept waiting when you were turning the corner. Now I'm going to see evidence that this is a second highest need school, and I don't think you saw it in terms of the built environment.
He's right. Not only has the building been rehabbed beautifully, but so has the entire neighborhood. What was once considered a slum has been rebuilt into a socioeconomically integrated neighborhood. The dramatic change was not without controversy, and some of the original residents were displaced. But it does highlight an important distinction that needs to be included with any comparison between Ontario and the U.S. or Pennsylvania. Ontario's commitment to equity in all realms, from healthcare to housing, has a tremendous effect on schooling. By and large, students there show up to school with comparatively less deficits, and then the schools have a greater ability to deal with the issues that persist. Mandela Elementary, for instance, provides doctors on site 3 days a week.
So if we can bring that medical care into the school in a space they already feel comfortable to come into, we can expedite getting medical referrals and services for kids that most need it.
All of this, of course, costs money. But here's the rub. Pennsylvania actually spends more money on education per student than Ontario, but in a much different way. the wealthiest districts in Pennsylvania taking about $1 billion more in revenue than the poorest districts, a difference of about $3,000 per child. Where Ontario values equality in the system, Pennsylvania values the individual's ability to maximize their own opportunities. I spoke about this dynamic with Helen Fisher, a top official of Toronto Schools, playing devil's advocate.
If you look at the priorities for Ontario, you'll look at its education for all. And that's what we stand behind.
But what about my kid?
Your kid is one of the all.
Yeah, but I want my kid to have the best opportunity possible.
And they will. In our public system, all kids will have that opportunity.
But they could be spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars more.
You know what? Every school will have those opportunities. Education for all is Ontario's mandate. It's a universal design.
Kevin McCrory, Keystone Crossroads.
This was part one of a series contrasting public school systems in Ontario and Pennsylvania. And tomorrow on Morning Edition, we'll examine one of the areas where Ontario still has much work to do, closing racial achievement gaps. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Tomorrow marks the 225th anniversary of the signing of the Bill of Rights, and we'll speak with constitutional scholar Akhil Reed Amar on how to think constitutionally about today's headline issues. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.